From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. 1 year ago, we were talking about living in a time of often extreme political polarization, where the problems of the day are drowned out by arguments and rhetoric. And this year seems to be no different, with too much political noise and not enough people talking about or trying to effectively solve those problems. The College of Idaho is tackling three of those problems this year in their second Idaho Policy Forum, bringing together a wide group of speakers to talk about the Open Primary Initiative, green energy, and school vouchers. And before next Wednesday's forum, we wanted to take a deeper dive into these topics as well. So here to talk about Idaho's Open Primary Initiative are Matthew May, research scholar with Idaho Policy Institute at Boise State University, Luke Mayville, co-founder of Reclaim Idaho, and Stelios Panayiotou, assistant professor of political economy with the College of Idaho. I want to welcome all of you to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be with you, Gemma.
Thanks, Gemma.
So let's jump right into the open primaries. Luke, I'll start with you. Can you tell us what's in your initiative and what it would do if passed?
Well, for years now, we've been hearing complaints about Idaho's political system, and it's not just coming from people in one party. It's coming from independents, from Democrats, from Republicans. And what they're saying is that our elected officials are out of touch with ordinary voters, that they're not listening. They're not focused on solving real problems. Instead, they're focused on really attacking each other. And those of us supporting the Open Primaries Initiative believe that the root of this problem is the fact that we have a closed primary election system. This is a system where most of our elected officials are elected in closed primary elections, elections where very few people vote. Only about 20 to 30% of those who are eligible to vote, vote in these elections. These are elections where over a quarter of a million independent voters are essentially blocked from voting. The only way that they can participate is if they give up their independent status and join a party they don't belong to. So those of us behind this initiative, we believe that that's wrong, and that's why we're proposing an open, nonpartisan primary where all voters, regardless of party affiliation, have a right to vote. We're taking after a reform recently enacted in Alaska, where everyone votes in the same primary, regardless of party, where all candidates appear on the same primary ballot. And from there, the top four candidates who win the most votes go on to the general election. And then in the general election, voters have the freedom to not just choose their first choice, but also choose backup choices. So to rank in their order of preference, who's my second choice, my third choice, my fourth choice. And the important thing to realize about that is that gives voters more voice, more choice in the political process. And that's going to lead to better leadership, because the reason why voters are powerful is because politicians have to compete for their vote. So when voters have more choice and more of a voice in the process, that's how we're going to get better leaders who are focused on really solving real problems rather than, as I mentioned earlier, these bitter controversies that really turn us against each other.
So, Matthew, can we go talk a little bit deeper about the difference between our current closed GOP primary, as Luke mentioned, and this open primary initiative? Like, what are the real big differences?
Sure. So the main difference is, I should first clarify that under kind of primary scholarship, we kind of classify things open, closed, and then the top two in the blanket primary kind of sit off to the side. So it's a more open system, compared to what Idaho has now, but it's not what academics define as an open system, which is what Idaho had from 1972 through 2011. But right now you have to affiliate with a political party, and you have had to since 2011. And parties default to a closed primary restricted to only their party members, unless that party submits notice to the Secretary of State that they wish to open it up and allow other party members or other parties to cross over and participate in their primary. What the proposal right now is to implement kind of a variant of the more established top two, but expanding the number of candidates that make it through and advance the top four vote getters. And one of the reasons that these top two, top four primaries have been allowed under the Supreme Court's decisions up to this point is because it kind of deals with a distinction on whether the purpose of a primary is to have political parties nominate who their candidate in the general election is, or is it a first stage election contest that kind of precedes the general and helps winnow it down? And so the top two, top four primaries have so far survived legal challenges because it is viewed as a winnowing of the field rather than votes to decide who a political party's nominee is.
Okay. So the other part of the initiative is to switch to ranked choice voting. Luke, you mentioned this in the beginning of our conversation, but I want to kind of go a little bit deeper into that for a minute. So either Matthew or Luke, tell us again exactly how this ranked choice would work.
Well, when you show up to vote in the general election in November, you'll have the freedom, if you want to only choose your top choice, just like you do now. But you'll also have the freedom to rank up to four candidates in your order of preference. So not just choose your first choice, but also your second choice, third choice, fourth choice. And the great thing about that is that if your first choice turns out to be someone who can't win and they come in last place, that candidate gets eliminated and your vote will now count towards your next choice. So it will mean that far more voters will have a meaningful say in the election. And that's ultimately so important if we want better leadership, because we want leaders who care about what the broader community thinks and what the broader community wants and needs. We don't want leaders who only care about what one small slice of the population wants. So this system really puts elected officials in a place where they have to be more responsive and accountable to the broader community.
Mm. I mean, I think it's fair to say that ranked choice voting can be complicated or seem complicated. And only a few states, I believe, like Alaska, have actually considered this ranked choice voting. So Matthew, a question for you. What have you learned about this kind of voting system and how it works?
I think it's still pretty early to kind of determine how the system works. We have just a couple of examples of it being used at this level. I think one of the issues that these systems have had to wrestle with is the subject of what are termed exhausted ballots, where even though voters have the opportunity to rank more than one candidate, if they only mark one or two and don't fill out the ballot, it's possible that their ballots are going to be exhausted and removed from the counts in successive rounds used to determine the overall winner. So for instance, in Maine, the second congressional district in Maine this last year, there were about 1,300 ballots that got exhausted between the first and second round, which had the final result of a 53% winner. If those original ballots had been included, would actually drag the percentage down to 51%. So it would still be a majority, but just slightly less of one. In Alaska, 11,000 ballots didn't transfer from the first round to the second round. And so the 51% that Mary Peltola won by was actually 48% of the total ballots that were cast in the first round. So the risk you have here is a potential of presenting a plurality as a majority, but still it's kind of incumbent upon whether the voter chooses to fill out the entire ballot or not.
Mm. Okay. So Stelios, let me bring you into the conversation. Why did you want to take a deep dive into the Open Primary Initiative in this upcoming forum at the College of Idaho?
Yeah, well, we at the College of Idaho are fundamentally committed to a democratic political system. And we think that this matters almost more than anything right now for our democracy, because we know that elections are the bedrock of a democracy. This is how citizens are going to choose their representatives. who are supposed to take their constituent interests and legislate in their favor, right? And so this is a ballot initiative. This is a feature of a direct democracy where voters themselves are asked if they want to make a change to the state laws. And this doesn't rely on the representatives to do so. So we think citizens need to be informed about this. And I want to, you know, step back for a second and say that there are different ways to hold an election. There's no one standard way across the world, across time, within various states in the United States. They do this differently. And so how we choose these representatives matters, and there's tremendous variation. A lot of people don't understand even what a primary is and why it's important to think through its structure. And so we want to put this on and go into a deep dive to provide this information, because it can be incredibly complex, but it's the background conditions for our democracy. So we want to ask what kind of primary system enhances representation. How do we get better alignment between the candidates that we elect and the majority of citizens? What are the implications for moving from an open to closed primary in 2011? What happens if we open it up? What happens if we add in ranked choice voting? What is it? And we think that Idahoans need to understand each of these dimensions and what this means for our democracy.
So, Luke, why did your organization decide to combine opening up the closed primary and ranked choice voting? I mean, does this make the hill climbing that you need to be doing to get all of these signatures in order to get this on the ballot more difficult? I mean, would it have been, I guess, even more difficult, though, to try to get two initiatives passed?
Our view is that the Alaska model that has combined the top four open primary with ranked choice voting, that's the model that's actually going to address the problem we have in our state. Some would say you could opt instead for the model that, you know, Washington State or California have, where they have a top two open primary, nonpartisan primary, and they don't have any ranked choice voting. Well, the problem with those systems is that there's not a whole lot of choice for most voters, because most voters don't vote in the primary. They show up and they vote in the general election. And in a top two system, you show up and vote, and you only have two choices. And oftentimes, by the way, they're from the same party in Washington State and California. Mm-hmm. We opted for the top four system because we want voters to have more choice. We want there to be more real competition by elected officials for people's votes, because competition is really what makes elected officials accountable to the public who they're supposed to serve. And then, but then importantly, once you open it up to four candidates instead of just two, you've got to have ranked choice voting, because ranked choice voting is a way to guarantee that you don't split the vote four ways and end up electing someone who, say, only has 25% of the vote. We want ranked choice voting requires a candidate, in order to win, they have to actually cobble together something much closer to a majority. They have, because the only way you can win in a ranked choice voting process is by making sure that you really represent a broad broad coalition of voters. Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to know what each of you are hearing about the open primary initiative, you know, what people are saying about it. Do folks understand ranked choice voting? And I'm asking this because I think I'm fairly intelligent. I understand the open primary, you know, ranked choice voting. Even as we're sitting here talking about it, I am still trying to fully understand it and how, you know, and really how the math works on it, I guess. And so, Luke, I want to start with you. What are you hearing as you're gathering signatures?
Well, there are quite a few people who have never heard about ranked choice voting, but once we're able to actually have a conversation about it, it becomes very clear how it works. From the level of a voter, it's really not more complicated than counting to four, really. because all you have to do is show up and choose your first choice, second choice, third choice, fourth choice. That's it. And again, if you prefer, you can only choose one choice or two choices. So it's okay. Really no more complicated than that. The only part that's a little bit more complicated is how the vote is then counted, how the votes are then counted. That's not done by ordinary voters. That's done by election officials. And even that part is pretty simple. Really what happens is that the very first thing is that all of the first choices are counted, just like an ordinary election. But importantly, it doesn't stop there. In the next round of counting, what happens is whoever came in last place, they get eliminated. And if you voted for that last place candidate, your vote now goes to your next choice. And then that happens in another round. So whoever came in third place, they're then eliminated. And then if you voted for that candidate, your vote now goes towards your next choice. And once you've narrowed it down to just two candidates remaining, whoever has the most votes wins. It's very similar if you've ever voted in a runoff election. It's essentially the same thing, but it all happens instantly. That's why it's sometimes called an instant runoff.
Can I interrupt really quick and just ask you a question? Does the person who win, do they have to get a majority, and by majority, at least 50% of the vote, or is it just whoever ends up having the most votes? Does that make sense?
Good question. So there are different ways to design a ranked choice voting system. The way we've designed it, there's no hard requirement that the candidate has to get over 50%, but essentially you end up with someone who's at 50% or close to it, because what that process that I just described does is it narrows it down to just the top two candidates by eliminating the fourth place and the third place. And then if you narrow it down to two candidates and you choose the candidate with the most votes, that candidate's going to have over 50% of those remaining votes. So it ends up being the case. And Matthew brought up earlier some of the complications over, can it be 48%? Can it be, maybe it's 48, 49. But one thing that the system really guarantees, whether or not it requires you to get over 50, it guarantees that you do have a very broad coalition supporting you. You cannot win with 26% of the vote. And that's the kind of problem that you have it with systems where there isn't ranked choice voting. And not to mention right now, a really serious problem that we have when you combine it with the primary system is that a candidate can essentially, win elections in Idaho just by winning the primary, where only, 20 to 30% of the voting age population votes. They just win in the primary and then they coast to victory in the general election. So they never actually had to prove that they have support from a broad coalition of voters. And it's no surprise then that they govern in such a way where they don't really represent the broader community.
We are going to wrap this conversation up for now. I really appreciate all three of you chatting with us. I know, Stelios, you're going to come back a little bit later to talk more about school vouchers. But up next, we're going to talk about this second issue that the College of Idaho will be talking about in their forum next week, and that is the future of green energy. But I do want to thank Matthew May, Luke Mayville, and Stelios Paniotou for this conversation about open primaries in Idaho. You ask someone if they're in favor of saving the planet and making it greener, it's really hard to find a negative response. I mean, almost everybody wants to live on a healthier Earth. However, the issue is, how do we get there? Because that's what becomes extremely political. And when we look at things like gas stoves to pizza ovens, green energy has been a polarizing topic in the news this year. So green energy is the second topic the College of Idaho's Policy Forum will tackle next week. Talking to us today about this is Lisa Young, the director of the Idaho Sierra Club, Brian Jones, executive director of Geothermal Rising, and Ryan McGildrick, program director of Conservation Voters for Idaho. I want to welcome all of you to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, I really appreciate you guys coming in for this. And Ryan, I want to just start with a simple question. Why, in your opinion, is green energy such a polarizing political subject?
I think actually I'd say in Idaho, I don't think it's as politically divisive as it might be in other places. I think because we don't have a lot of fossil fuel resources in Idaho. So the opportunities that we do have for economic benefit are largely in clean energy and green energy. So we actually see a lot of support among kind of liberal communities and conservative communities in Idaho for transitioning to clean energy, because they see the benefits that it has to build solar farms and build wind turbines in their community. As long as it's done the right way with community input, a lot of times we've seen that actually be popular throughout the state.
Lisa, would you agree with that sentiment with Ryan that we tend to not have as hard of a political divide with this issue?
Yeah, great question. I would overall agree with what Ryan said. There's just so much opportunity, economic opportunity, of course, jobs, people are beginning to really understand that the impacts of climate change are here with us here and now, and that this transition is happening. The prices are falling for these energy, sources. And so, the transition is happening and people are beginning to come on board. I'd say, there are still, parts of the topic that are more divisive than others. And the one that we are running into a lot right now is ownership. Who gets to own all these new clean energy resources and really truly benefit the most from them? And, one of those really being, customer-owned generation, when people can actually put solar panels on their roof and generate that power there. The utility companies right now are really pushing back against that. They want to be able to own those clean energy resources themselves, because again, there is so much to benefit from that profit, and they're really excellent energy sources. So the one kind of controversial area that we are running into is allowing individuals on the ground, customers, local residents, local businesses to own those resources themselves, have them on their property, and be able to help generate this clean energy for our grid.
So, Brian, your thoughts on this? Do you believe it's polarizing here in our state? But also, as Lisa mentioned, what she thought maybe is a lot of pushback is who owns it. What would you say is the biggest kind of struggle that we face here in Idaho when it comes to, our populace having agreement about green energy?
Well, I would say one of the things I studied at Boise State University was the stagnation of technology adoption when it comes to the clean energy economy and transitioning into that economy. What it really does come down to policy and social decisions at the end of the day. And so in Idaho, I think there are policies that can help the deployment of clean energy technologies that are still lacking and that can be improved upon to fully transform Idaho into this clean energy economy.
Ryan, how often would you say that generations play into this? And what I mean by that is different generations of individuals. Because when I talk with, let's say Gen Z, right? They're very much aware of climate change, very much aware of what it's doing to our planet. But then maybe we talk with someone who is of an older generation, and it doesn't seem to maybe resonate as much. Is that something that you see? And then if it is, how do we work for every person to understand that we can all take ownership of this?
I think there absolutely is a kind of generational divide in why people support clean energy and what kind of their motivation is. We see, as you said, with younger people are looking to the future and the impacts of climate change. What's that going to have for the impact that's going to have on their community, on communities of color, on our low income communities? But I think one of the benefits of clean energy is that there is a benefit that everyone can see. I remember seeing with a farmer who was close to retirement in Idaho was talking about putting on some of his land that was not as usable for farming. He wanted to put on solar panels and got a contract to put on a bunch of solar panels. So it allowed him to have funding so he could retire when he needed to and also be able to protect that land for future generations. So I think there is a lot of, there's different reasons that people from different generations might be looking at the benefits of clean energy. But I think the exciting part is that we can all kind of see benefits in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, I have about a minute left. I would love to ask you, what is something that, you know, any one person could do right now that would help create a greener planet?
Well, I've got an answer for you. In many ways, right, the quick answer is to get involved, make your voice heard in some of these policy decisions, kind of like Bryant was mentioning. There are, you know, things out there that they are looking for public input on, and that can help shape these broad policies that then help kind of that mass deployment of clean energy in our communities. So there is a case at the Public Utilities Commission right now. There's actually a hearing in Boise next week on Tuesday and one in Twin Falls on November 8th. You can attend that public hearing. You can submit public comments to help encourage rooftop solar affordability in our community. So that's one thing you can do right now, and go online to the PUC's website, the Public Utilities Commission, submit a comment, go to the hearings, and help advocate for this amazing clean energy resource in our communities.
I want to thank all three of you for coming in today and talking to us about this. We've been talking with Lisa Young, Director of the Idaho Sierra Club, Bryant Jones, Executive Director of Geothermal Rising, and Ryan McGoldrick, Program Director for Conservation Voters for Idaho, talking about green energy and politics. The topic of school vouchers was an easy choice for the organizers of next Wednesday's Idaho Policy Forum at the College of Idaho, and we're going to jump right into that now. So back with us is Stelios Peniotou, Assistant Professor for Political Economy at the College of Idaho, along with Mae Roberts, Policy Analyst, Idaho Center for Fiscal Policy, and Nancy Gregory, President of Idaho School Boards Association. Stelios, I just want to start with this. Why are school vouchers so controversial?
Yeah, thanks, Gemma. I think school vouchers are so controversial because this is about our children and the way that they're going to get education. And it's not simply that all schools are going to provide the same education, and parents really care about how those kids are getting educated, but it's also wrapped up in a lot of ideals about how to deliver this. So I think that we should step back and ask the question over what is the purpose of education, which has a long history as being the bedrock of a democratic, free society. And the reason is that education cultivated virtue and citizenship. It's more than job training. It's essential to creating a well-rounded person in society. So we at the College of Idaho, we take education very seriously, and we know that this has become a lightning rod issue. And I think we need to put all of the players on the table here that privatization of schools is controversial because we have various interests, and all of the framing of this plays into our political ideologies. So how do we put this all out there so that Idahoans know the stakes, the different players involved in this landscape?
Mm-hmm. So Mae, a similar question to you. In your opinion, why do you think school vouchers are so polarizing? Because it's not just polarizing here in Idaho, it is an issue across our country.
Thank you, Gemma. We've seen school vouchers, the legislation, become a lot more popular over the last couple years, especially universal voucher programs. And I've seen that the universal voucher program becoming more controversial because it's serving everybody. So there's no income limitations on it. Vouchers at one point in certain states would just serve students with disabilities or very low income. So over the last couple of years, we've seen universal school vouchers that can serve everyone, including students that are already in private schools. That can be a very polarizing thought, that these dollars are going to families that already are able to afford private education for their students.
Mm. So, Nancy, where does the Idaho School Boards Association weigh in on school vouchers?
The Idaho School Boards Association stands in opposition to school vouchers. This speaks to what Celios was talking about. What is the interest here? And the government has an interest in an educated populace. And our Constitution requires that the government set up a system of public education that is free to all. And because of that, everyone has access and everyone benefits. and everyone pays. Now, some could say, well, if I pay, but I want to send my child to a private school, then I want that tax money to go to my private school. When in fact, everyone does benefit from public education. And public education is under attack, I would say, from those who believe that the government should not be in the business of education. When in fact, the government providing public education is kind of part of our social contract as citizens in our country, because we all have those interests that Stelios talked about. An educated populace that can sustain a democracy, that can contribute to the economy, that can create viable communities. So those are some of the common interests that we all enjoy the benefit of when government is in the business of public education.
So, Nancy, how much do you believe a larger school voucher program would impact the way public schools and maybe even school boards function here in Idaho? And because I'm wondering if, you know, if all of a sudden you've got, you know, a check and you can send your kid wherever, you know, to school, wouldn't some schools be, you know, so negatively impacted, whereas other schools would get so much more money that, I mean, where's the checks and balances in that, I guess, when it comes to how we educate our children?
That's a very good question. Vouchers in a rollout, we don't have to look very far across the country to see what the effect has been of vouchers. But in the state of Idaho, I would say that they would take scarce funding from public schools. Public schools serves 94% of Idaho's kids. And then they would give that public money to private schools and for-profit institutions that are not accountable to taxpayers. And so we do not believe that taxpayers should be obligated to support two separate school systems. And we anticipate, and we can see instances in other states where property taxes would spike because scarce resources would be pulled from public schools, and public schools would have to go to the taxpayers for bonds and levies, which have been made harder to get by the legislature, to just keep the doors open in their schools. Because what happens when you have a voucher program is they don't take a whole school section of kids to another school. They take one here, one there, one here, one there, and they don't reduce the standing costs of running that public school. But you've lost the funding anyway. Mm. And so essentially, vouchers are going to be, by and large, used by people who are already in the private school system. They have already chosen to go to private schools, mostly because we find statistically that fewer public school students leave the system and without returning quickly because they are uninformed about the eligibility requirements in private schools, possible restrictions, and they don't understand the loss of parent rights and student rights when they go to the private sector. And then they're kind of like a revolving door. They get admitted and then they get exited and they're back to public schools.
I have about 2 minutes left with you. And Stelios, I would like to talk very quickly, if we can, you know, about the legislature. And really, we have a GOP-dominated legislature here in Idaho. How do they, or how can they, reconcile kind of this stated belief of personal freedom, yet then have a pushback against school vouchers?
Well, I think, you know, this past legislative session had, I think it was 7 bills that were seen before the legislature, and they failed. So I think we have to wonder why that was. Why, like, is it an equal landscape where the voice of school choice is as big as a resistance that says we need to protect public schools? These legislatures are getting feedback from their constituents, and that's leading to their behavior too. So one of the things that we do want to do in this panel is understand what happened this past legislative session and to understand why those bills failed? And is there a dominant view that really does emerge in Idaho about public schools and the value of it? Or, you know, where is the school choice sort of perspective coming from? And we'll have to understand the various ways that we understand politics and public goods and the market. Is the market the best way to handle a public good like education? Do voters feel that way or not? Do we need to understand that the government does have a role to play in this? So we want to look historically at this past session and understand that this stuff is going to keep happening, so that the people attending the forum will come out knowing a lot more about what's been going on from these experts and officials and working in the system.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.